Good morning and welcome. This episode is about to get started, but before that, a few things you should know. First of all, this show is brought to you for free. To support, please consider sharing the episode with your friend, leaving a great review, or signing up for my bi-monthly top 5 email. What is it? It's a free email that I craft twice a month and send out to thousands of you, where I share what inspired me recently, books and film that had an impact on me, but also gear and tips and things I've been thinking about lately that really impacted me in a way. If you too want to join in on the fun, please visit ptl.fm/top5, T-O-P-5, and you will be in for the next edition. Now, last but not least, all podcast show notes are available at ptl.fm/podcast. Thank you so much for being here, and let's get started. Good morning, podcast, and welcome to a new episode. It's been a while, and today we have a legendary guest. His name is David Burnett. He's an award-winning photojournalist. He's covered historical events from the Vietnam War to the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Iranian Revolution. He was present during the 1973 coup in Chile and also photographed the aftermath of 9/11 attacks. You may have seen his work on many magazine covers, including Time magazine, and you may recognize some of the portraits that he's shot, for example, of Bob Marley, John F. Kennedy, and other Olympic athletes. One of his famous portraits also includes the shot of Al Gore during the 2000 US presidential election, which became one of his most recognized work. He also is the co-founder of Contact Press Images. In 1976, he created this agency, which became a platform for many influential photographers worldwide. In this conversation, we're gonna have a lot of interesting stories. For example, how they used to get film to the magazines on time while asking for random people in the streets and in airports to bring the film back to the US. There's a lot of fun stories behind that that you will see David is sharing that really shows us the shift that has been in media over the years. And we'll talk about that too. On top of that, some of his latest projects and how he chose them, what interests him, and how we can kind of apply it. I think there's a lot of lessons in how he shares things that we can apply to our own life. For example, what about creative risk? What about interest? How do you blend all that to develop your curiosity as a photographer and see the world in a complete way? Now, for the fun story, years ago, I met David at an event and we recorded a whole conversation together and the podcast recording did not work. It was a really difficult moment for me to actually go to a legendary photographer and tell him that, hey, our recording didn't work out. So everything we've been talking about is just gone and will just stay in my own memory and maybe his. But today in this conversation, I hope to redempt a little bit myself. We have a short but intense podcast, so let's get right into it. I hope you will enjoy.
Good morning, David.
Hello, good to see you.
Thanks for joining me.
Bright, overcast morning in Santa Barbara.
The last place where I thought we would have overcast days.
Well, it's something quite magical about this giant softbox of light that everybody looks good.
That is very true. For portraits, it's been pretty interesting. I have been following your adventures. We recorded a podcast that was just for us many years ago. And I'm very excited to go into that conversation a little bit back. I watched your talk yesterday. There was a lot that was about legendary photographers. And I was struck by one thing, which was the discrepancy, maybe the shift, and I heard that from other photographers, between photography nowadays and maybe a few years back, and a little shift in how people think about it and how they want to learn about it. And I was kind of wondering what your feeling has been in terms of evolution for yourself and how you create photos, and maybe from when you started to now and how you approach it.
I don't know that I see the world terribly different than when I was in my teens or 20s and just starting out in journalism. What has really changed is the structure of the kind of places where we used to get work or be hired, or we would go out on our own. I mean, I did a lot of this where I would go produce the story first and then we would try and sell it. And there had been going back to the mid-1960s when the French photo agency Gamma started, and I ended up working for Gamma and from 1973 to 1975, and I really was dipped into that magical French attitude of, if the story is worth doing, let's go do it and not wait for an assignment. And if the pictures are good enough, there was still a very broad and deep world of magazines, primarily magazines, some newspapers, but mainly magazines that would buy the pictures or technically speaking, would license the images for use in their magazines. And that world was fantastic. The magazines had a lot of advertising. They had budgets. They wanted to be good every week. The very competitive ones, for example, in the States between Time Magazine and Newsweek, every week they wanted to beat up each other. They wanted to be the best. And I think they understood that one of the ways of doing that was getting good photography and trying to play it well. So you had a lot of opportunities that were offered by this structure of magazines and of publication. And now as I look back on it, I feel like I was really very lucky to have lived and worked in that era, because all of that is kind of dried up and gone away. There's not that much advertising to support, in the traditional way advertising supported publications. They still have ads, but the magazines just aren't what they once were. They're not these venues for so much for great photography. It isn't the first place anyone looks. For the last 20 years, it's all been the internet and online and what's happening online. Let's find the latest thing. And what I think is kind of the unfortunate offshoots of the way online viewing has replaced magazines is that the useful shelf life of pictures has been drastically cut, because when you had it in a weekly magazine, maybe you'd see it on a Wednesday and you'd have the magazine around for a few days and maybe even look at it a week later. And those pictures had a way of living longer. And now it's on one screen and you swipe it on your phone or you click a mouse on your laptop and on to the next one. And it has had, I think it's had the attitude of kind of cheapening the value of photography and not really giving photography its due. That's how I feel about it. And I'm sure people would say, well, it gets as much due as it deserves. Maybe, but I don't think so. And it's been, I look back on it and I think I was a very lucky guy to be working in the 1960s and 70s and 80s when the respect given to those kind of photographic projects was much greater and the usage was good. If you got good pictures on a story, somebody was going to use them. And now maybe they'll end up on a website or maybe even just your own personal website. And they're just not meant to be held in your hand and swirled around like you would a little cognac, you know, and kind of taste it and reflect on it. Now it's just, give me more, give me more, give me more.
Interesting. Speaking of that back, like how it was working, I'm curious because it's something that I grew up in. Sure, I was in the film era when I was young, but I never thought of how it works to get film to a place to get it really fast out to the news, right? When you're on the other side of the world, I would just go home after my holiday, you know, and take my time. How did this work for you? How did it work for you? And do you have like an example or a place where it was a little outrageous how you guys got film?
Well, the ultimate payoff on anything you did away from home was figuring out how do you get the film transported, because you make your pictures and now they're all sitting on an undeveloped roll of film and maybe there's 10 rolls of film or 20 rolls of film. And for that purpose, the airline air sickness bags were very handy. And so instead of vomiting in the bag, you put your film in there because they were plastic lined and they were actually, you know, they would protect the film in case it got dropped in a rainstorm or something. But yeah, well, you had to get your film out. That was your job. As one of my friends used to say, I'll shoot a job and I'll get the film and I'll make a packet out of it. And either you would go to the air freight office and make a whole official thing, or you would sometimes just go to the airport and try and find a passenger who could carry your film. And when I was working during the Iranian Revolution in Tehran, shipping film, oh, I don't know, three or sometimes four times a week. Every other day, we would go. My best friend, Olivier Ribot, worked for Newsweek, and I worked for Time Magazine. We were arch rivals and best friends.
Oh, wow.
And we often would go on these stories together because you wanted to have somebody who was around to see if something bad happened to you, at least to be able to notify others and try and, you know, I mean, I suppose we all could have worked individually, but it was also more fun. But at the same time, I was always trying to make a better picture than him. And you know, there were times when I did that, and there were times when he got the better picture. But together, we would make a big packet of all of our film, Newsweek and Time Magazine, arch rivals, and go to the airport and wander into the departure lounge and try and find somebody who was going to Paris or to London or to a place where, once we gave him the film, you know, part of the formula was, when you get to Paris and walk out of customs, look for someone with a big red envelope that says Time Magazine and give the film to that person. And then our person who would take the film would then get it on a regularly scheduled plane to New York. That was the easy part. The hard part was getting it out of, you know, Poland and martial law or Iran during the revolution. I mean, it's a lot of the social structures broke down, and you couldn't just go to the air freight office and make a package because the plane stopped flying. Like I had done a story in Pakistan, and I came on Christmas Day. I flew to Tehran, and at the airport, I went to the Pan American Airways freight office, which was a little building right next to the main terminal, and I filled out all the paperwork, and this packet is going to New York. And then Pan Am stopped flying to Tehran because the civil unrest was such that they didn't want to subject their crews to what was going on there. And 2 days later, 3 days later, I was going to make another passenger, and I looked in at Pan Am and I saw my film sitting there on the counter. I thought that it's never moved one inch. And I managed to somehow get inside and I picked up the old film and I got it all to New York. But it was the kind of thing where nothing was assured about it. You had to, you were always taking chances on the most important things, which was delivering your film to the head office.
What was a sales pitch for an unknown person?
Well, it was, you would kind of, usually if I'd had a picture in last week's Time Magazine or Olivier had one in Newsweek, we would open it to that page and say, oh, see this story about what happened here last week, that picture? And people are like, yeah. I said, well, I took that picture. Wow, okay, that you really, yeah. I said, that's my picture. And this film is what I took this week. And that's why it's so important that this film make it to Paris and then make it on to New York. And we would, with my friend Olivier, we would walk into the departure lounge, and mostly it was full of people who were fleeing Iran. They just wanted to get out. And they had these kind of serious, dark looks on their face, worried, always worried about not being able to get on that airplane. Those were not the people you wanted to give the film to. You wanted somebody who had a little bit more self-confidence in the situation, And that you could be sure it wouldn't just, oh, this is getting to be too much, and just throw your film in a trash can. But every time we did it, it worked. The film got to New York, went to Time, went to Newsweek. The next week we'd have pictures published, and then we'd start all over again.
Do you think that would work nowadays?
No, I mean, I go to the airport, and there are these announcements every 20 minutes. If anyone you don't know tries to give you something, it's like, and I always want to cry, I need to ship my film. But there's no way, they don't even understand, they can't understand what that means.
Mm.
They don't know what film is. Most people don't really know what film is. And let alone 30 or 40 rolls of film that you shot and put a little code on it and some caption information. It's, you know, given what's happened with security, digital photography makes much more sense because it doesn't have the constraints that it would have if you were obliged to make sure that every time you went to the airport, you could get your film taken somewhere. And I've always had very good luck doing that. When people understand what's at stake, I don't think I've ever had a case where the film was lost.
Hmm.
But, you know, there's always a first time. So
that's such a... I can't imagine, like, the fact that you have to go to the airport to the departure lounge, it's like a whole part of your job. That's what takes a long time, right?
Sure.
It's like, so you're there on assignment, and on top of that, you have to make sure. So it's interesting how it shifts that. Now you just go to your hotel room, upload something, or if you're lucky, you upload straight from your camera, like we saw with the recent assassination attempt with Trump. Everything, the photographers didn't even know, but I mean, didn't even see their photos before the editors did. And I find that the shift is so interesting. Where would you like to go? Do you want to... I have two angles here. I have one that's around objectivity in moment of conflict and one that's around balance between commercial and personal. Do you have a preference?
Well, I haven't done much commercial work lately, so maybe that doesn't make sense because I'm not... I haven't had any real... advertising work for like 8 or 9 years. It's definitely become, at a time when there's all these great technology breakthroughs, it's harder and harder to get interesting work, I find. So I mean, I end up doing things that interest me and not necessarily wait to be assigned. I'm working on this project on older athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really been fun. And they're kind of my, you know, my people. There's, I mean, 70s, 80s, and people who are still very rock solid and wanting to be athletic into their 80s and 90s. And I think the one thing, I did an exhibition with the first batch of photographs, and one afternoon, I just was hanging around the gallery just to kind of hear what people have to say, because you don't want to go up and say, yes, I'm the photographer, because then people are, they kind of feel obliged to be nice. But I really wanted to hear what they thought. And the one word I just kept hearing all the time was inspiring, inspiration, inspiring. Oh, I'm so inspired by this. I got to get my tennis racket out. And you would hear people really reacting to these pictures of 60 and 70 year old athletes. To me, that's really fun. When you have something that's so concrete that people can relate to it, not everything's going to be like that, but when it does happen, it's really makes you feel like the work you did was really worth doing. And
do you remember the moment or the maybe the events that led to you choosing that project?
Well, I made a proposal to an arts council, and I got a grant. I don't remember how much money it was, but it was like enough to get me out and going on the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to spent a week at the National Senior Games, which are the people from all over the country will every 2 years, and this one was in 2017 or 2018 in Montgomery, Alabama, and hundreds, thousands of athletes show up. Wow. You have to be at least 50, and everything is in a 5-year, it's like 50 to 54,
oh, wow.
55, 58. So all the people that are just on the edge of, you know, like when you're in the 70 to 74. Well, when you're 74, you're competing against people that are 73, 72, 71, and 70. And that, you know, you may think, oh, that gives them a little bit of an advantage. But if you make it one more year, when you're 75, now you're the youngest. Yeah. And you're competing with the 76, 77, 78, 79-year-olds. And so you kind of have, and with these 5-year breaks, it creates all kinds of different psychology about how people are trying to be athletic. But mostly, they just are not going to, they're people that don't want to just sit around and go get old. They want to play basketball. They want to play shuffleboard, their baseball, softball. Track and field is huge.
Track and field.
80-year-old women doing shot put.
Wow.
I mean, it's really fun. It is inspiring because you see, these are people that could just be sitting around at home, you know, baking cookies or something. Like, oh, what's grandma doing? Well, she's not baking cookies. She's out, you know, throwing javelin at age 85. It's pretty fun because it is a side of human endeavor which is not highly seen. I have actually in the Chateau de Vincennes the end of the number one metro line, we had an exhibition of large laminated prints so they could be outdoors in front of the chateau all during the Olympic Games. And people would kind of wander by, and instead of seeing the world champion pole vaulter, they would see, you know, a 75-year-old pole vaulter and a 85-year-old sprinter, and people really love this stuff. Because it's something that's so different in the way you think about elderly people. And that maybe, and, you know, then as a photographer, it was like, I love this story. I just can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
I'm always surprised. I'm surprised by what I see, and I'm surprised at how fun the pictures are. It's a fun, very positive thing.
How did you land on that story? What triggered your interest in it?
I think it kind of originally started. Somebody said, "Oh, have you heard about, you know, you're having dinner with somebody?" And it's like, "Have you heard about, you know, there's this group of old athletes?" And you know, I've done a lot of Olympic games, so for me, it was very often they call their competition the Senior Olympics, even though the Olympic Committee doesn't like them to do that, but they do it anyway, and it kind of garners attention, and people are drawn to it. It sounds kind of interesting. You want to know what that means. And that's kind of what got me interested. And I went to the first time I spent a week at the Senior Games in Alabama. I couldn't believe how much fun it was. It was, oh my God, the swimmers. They are driven. They're driven like Olympic athletes.
Wow.
And somebody who's doing their 100 laps just to stay in shape, you know, back and forth and back and forth, don't get in their way. They will go through you like a buzzsaw. I mean, it's really, and I love seeing that because I'm kind of at that age where it would be real easy to just say, oh, you know, I'm going to retire. I don't want to do anything. I just want to read books or write books. And when you see how people have decided not to just become sedentary and retire and do who knows what, it is really fun to see it. And I'm happy that I can both see it and record it with my camera.
Yeah, there's something about the vitality of that still comes through.
No, it's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, those people were right. It is inspiring.
Yeah.
Because you think, you know, unless you have some kind of really terrible illness, you realize that everybody has something left in them to do it.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I was talking to Neil yesterday at lunch, and I was asking him what keeps him to still work in a way, or like still do photography, because I was curious. A lot of people, like you mentioned, around that age could sit at home or be retired or something. Yeah. And it's like, how, it's what makes one decide to continue? And for you personally, is it the passion around photography that keeps you going, or?
Yeah, I mean, I love the way being a photographer lets me interact with life all around me in ways that are probably, you know, it provides you an excuse to be able to just plunge in to other people's lives without feeling terribly self-conscious about it.
That's funny. I see. Can you tell me a little bit about one of your favorite portraits, I would say? Both, maybe not necessarily the most famous, but the one that struck you the most in your career?
There's a lot of them. One of my favorite pictures is the summit meeting between Mikhail Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan in 1985. Hmm. And in the summer of 1985, it was announced that Mikhail Gorbachev was going to rise to the rank of, I think, first party secretary was how they described his title. But essentially, he was going to become the guy in charge of the Soviet Union and the government. And very shortly thereafter, it was announced that his first foreign trip was going to be to France. And I think it was President Mitterrand. And so I went to Time Magazine, and I guess I was the first guy to say, I think we need to cover the new general secretary is coming to France. And they said, yeah, great idea. And sometimes you just, on a simple thing, even though it was like pretty well known, if you're the first one that gets the idea through the door, you, not always, but that gives you a chance to be the one where they say, yeah, you can do this job, go ahead. So I didn't really travel with I traveled with the Americans, but I didn't have a, since there were already several Time Magazine photographers on the trip, I went as my own agency, Contact Press Images, and they ran out of photo passes for what was going to be the joint press conference at the very end of the trip. Because we'd had a picture of them shaking hands outside in November in Geneva, it was winter already. So they're wearing these big coats and it didn't look great. So I wanted to get into this final joint press conference where Reagan and Gorbachev were gonna be presenting themselves and talking about their meetings. And but the Americans didn't have enough photo passes to get me in there. Now, maybe if I'd really stayed on it, they would have found a pass for me, but I didn't want to risk it. And because of these bilateral, the way the bilaterals work, when they divide up the press tickets, each side gets exactly the same as the other. Mm. And I knew that the Soviets only had two or three photographers. They didn't have 15 photographers like the Americans did. So I went to see the Soviet press guy, and the event was supposed to start at like 3:30, and I went to see him at 2:30. I said, "Sir, I'm wondering if you could give me a ticket to get into the thing. I'm with a photo agency that's based in Paris and New York, and you know, made my case." And he said, "Well, you have to sit over there, and we'll see what we can do, but you have to be patient." I said, "Oh, I'm very patient." So I went, I sit for like 20 minutes, and I kind of look at him like, "What's happening? Anything happening here?" And he's like, "Please, you have to be patient." And then I keep waiting and waiting, and I can see the clock is moving, and I'm worried now about missing the whole thing. And finally, he, about 5 minutes before it starts, he says, here's your ticket. And he said, you know, you can be very patient. So patience is something that you need as a photographer. Mm. Sometimes you're in charge of what you're photographing. Sometimes you're just the least important person trying to be a witness to what it is. And so you have to have that sense of understanding and patience to be able to negotiate with the realities of life. But I walked into the room and the stage was there and I didn't have really much time to get ready. And 2 minutes later, they said, now the President of the United States and now the First Secretary. And they walk across and they shake hands. And then they sat down. And when they sat down, each one is listening to their interpreter, which means even though they were sitting right next to each other, Gorbachev is kind of listening that way and Reagan is listening this way. And that was my picture. And I shot it in a way that makes you feel like they're all by themselves, the two men with their interpreters, and they're this close to each other, but they're not hearing each other. They're only hearing from their interpreter. So, I mean, it was a good picture. Like a lot of good pictures, it didn't get used right away.
Yeah.
And then finally, in one of the year-end magazines, somebody ran it for 2 pages. So.
Wow. It's there's a lot of really interesting topics that you mentioned in there. I think the patience is one, and I think you were sharing your story yesterday with the Shah, where you also had the patience to wait a few days to have an opportunity.
I mean, I was really glad. I heard from some people after our little get together yesterday that they really thought there were some little bits of wisdom there, and I don't know, I kind of thought we weren't that interesting, but the audience apparently thought we were quite interesting, so that's more important than what I think.
And I
was very glad to hear that people actually thought it was a worthwhile session, because sometimes it's almost like we're just sitting around with our friends talking, you know, because it was, it had that element, which probably made it more interesting.
Yeah, and if Sony publishes it, I'll link it for anyone listening also. But it's like you can control what you put out, you don't control how it's being received, right? Mm-hmm. And I guess it's the same with your photo. You said a lot of good photos are not used in the moment, they're used way later.
And you just hope they have, you know, the thing is about photography, the good pictures in most cases will eventually rise to the top. Mm. Not always. Sometimes I'll go through.
Look. Before you go, quick question. Would you like to receive twice a month for free my top 5 email? It's an email that I craft with love and passion, in which I share what inspired me recently, books and film that had an impact on me, but also things I've been thinking about, gear, tips and photos that I absolutely love. If that resonates with you, if you want to peek into that universe, please join thousands of other readers. Sign up for free at ptl.fm/top5. That's ptl.fm/top5. Thank you so much and have a beautiful day. Remember, try something different, try something new.